Lord, let your fire fall on our hearts, our minds, our lives, and our church right now. Fill us to overflowing with your life-giving joy and endless love. Convict, convince, convert, and construct with your fiery presence that we might know you, see you, love you, and follow you. And may only your words be heard this evening. Amen. You may be seated. In 2004, LendingTree produced one of the funniest commercials ever. Titled Help, the commercial features a man smiling from ear to ear, looking abundantly happy. Here's the script if you don't remember it. I'm Stanley Johnson. I've got a great family, a four-bedroom house, and a great community. Like my car, it's new. I even belong to the local golf club. His smile borders on the absurd. It's a picture of the good life. Family, house, community, car, even golf. Sounds a little bit like Augusta. But then the commercial pivots. Stanley is still smiling, but something has shifted. While cleaning his beautiful pool, he continues, "How do I do it? I'm in debt up to my eyeballs." As he sits on his riding lawnmower, he finishes, "I can barely pay my finance charges. Somebody help me." Poor Stanley. He wanted the American dream, felt the need to keep up with the Joneses, but he hadn't counted the cost. In 2013, Oprah Winfrey's famous interview with Lance Armstrong aired. Rumors and allegations had been swirling for years about Armstrong, about his incredible feat of winning the Tour de France, the world's most grueling competition, 7 years in a row. But he cheated. Blood doping, performance-enhancing drugs, and that wasn't even the worst part. The most chilling part was during the interview when Oprah asked, "Was it worth it?" And he responded, "Yeah." In 2018, Avengers Infinity War storms the box office to the tune of $2.4 billion worldwide. After gathering all of the Infinity Stones, attaining ultimate power, Thanos, the baddest bad guy that you'll ever meet, snaps his finger and gets exactly what he wanted. But in a powerfully haunting vision, his daughter asks him, "What did it cost?" And he answers with one word, "Everything." His pursuit of power and glory required the sacrifice of the single relationship which mattered most to him. Win no matter the cost, keep up no matter the price, grab power or prestige or platform no matter the sacrifice. This is what the world has told us is true. This is what has been normalized around us as good. And then we encounter Jesus. The Jesus that we find in Luke's biography, that which we call a gospel, presents us with some hard sayings. But the hard sayings have hope if only we have the ears to hear and the eyes to see. Context is everything. Jesus has just finished a dinner party at the house of a Pharisee. As Joe said last Sunday, Jesus always serves heartburn when he's eating with the religious elite. In this instance, he's confronted their understanding of the Sabbath. He's called them to humility rather than hubris. And then he told a parable about the rich and the righteous erroneously missing out on a wedding banquet. Now Jesus describes the cost of discipleship, but Luke adds something. He says large crowds were traveling with Jesus. This teaching is not just for the 12 disciples who have been gathered already, nor is it for only the faithful who have been following for months or for years. This is a teaching for all people, the fickle and the feckless, the devout and the devoted, and everywhere in between. Jesus begins with two verses that sound a little harsh. Anyone who comes after him and who doesn't hate father and mother, sister and brother, wife and child, even one own life, cannot be his disciple. Is he, the Prince of Peace, really promoting hatred? The short answer, thankfully, is no. The word here can mean hate, but it can also have a little more nuance and mean love less. The implication is to love something less than the Lord. The real gist of what Jesus is saying here is that anyone who does not love their family or their life less than they love the Lord cannot be his disciple. This shouldn't be surprising. The first commandment of the ten was that you shall have no other gods before me. The greatest commandment was love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and with all of your strength. Jesus is not calling the crowd to defriend their families or to cut people out of their wills, though you may have people in your family for whom that is good. No, he's calling them to realign and reorganize their lives around God, to give up self-interest and self-preservation, to put away the idolatry of family or money or health or any of the other gods that we've created, and to put the real God at the center and let everything else orbit around him. Jesus isn't inviting the love of just any God, but the true and living God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Israel. This isn't the God of moralistic, therapeutic deism that wants you to be happy and be good in a vanilla sense. This isn't the God that we find on social media who hates everyone who doesn't vote like us or spend like us or look like us. This isn't even the God of human progress in whom we keep making him in our image. No, he's talking about the God that we see in Psalm 139, the God who made us and formed us, the God who knows us and searches us, who loves us and saves us. So Jesus puts a choice in front of them, a choice about discipleship, about truly following him or not. Our job as readers or as listeners is to examine the invitation that Jesus issues alongside the invitations that the world issues, alongside the other things vying for our attention, our affection, and our admiration. We live in an age of subscriptions, memberships, and loyalty rewards. You can subscribe to Netflix or Disney Plus for your entertainment, Spotify for your music, Audible for your books. You can subscribe to the Dollar Shave Club for your razors, HelloFresh for dinner, BarkBox for your dog, and yes, there is even a subscription box for golfers called Golf Locker. Boxes show up at your door, curated for you. Sign up now, cancel anytime, just one click of a button. You can be a member at Costco, Amazon Prime, Delta Sky Miles, a political party, or your local art gallery. Memberships come with exclusive perks, but the more exclusive, the more it's going to cost you. And then there's the loyalty rewards, American Express, Fresh Market, even Trellis down the hill, which I love, I promote. I get points for every cup of coffee I drink at Trellis, so I drink entirely too much coffee at Trellis to get more free cups of coffee. Loyalty isn't about how loyal I am to the company, but what the company gives me to honor my loyalty. That makes the turn to Jesus really sharp. Jesus doesn't offer a subscription model of discipleship. He's not after a monthly payment for grace. He doesn't promote rewards for our loyalty because he knows that we are fickle. He wants all of us, every single piece, no holding back. He pays the price on the cross. He pledges his loyalty. He promises his steadfast love, which is unending, unbreaking, unwavering, and unrelenting. And then he talks about carrying the cross to follow him. To be clear, the cross that you carry is not your family. Don't look at your family next to you and say, "You're my cross to carry." That's not what he's saying. It's not your job. It isn't your circumstances. It's not the cross of burdens or personal martyrdom, like having to wash all of the dishes in the kitchen after Thanksgiving. No, the cross here is an image of scorn and shame, of destruction and defeat, of humiliation and heartache. And that is the cost of following Jesus. That is the cost of discipleship. Jesus' hearers don't know that he's going to carry a cross soon. They don't know that he will be enthroned upon the cross, but he does. And he's been marching steadily towards that cross for 5 chapters. It's not an easy saying, but we don't follow Jesus because it's easy. We follow him because it's good. It isn't fast. It's fruitful and faithful. So Jesus lays it out for the entire crowd, for those who are already following and for those who are considering taking the plunge. And then he turns the screw one last time with 2 stories about the cost of discipleship. A landowner building a tower or a king waging a war against another king must count the cost of their campaign before they begin it. If one hasn't the money to complete the building or hasn't the army strength to see the war through, then it shouldn't be started in the first place. And that's when Jesus gives us his punchline. None of you can become my disciple if you do not give up your possessions. This is the point where people typically balk and blanch when hearing his words. You can have my Sunday morning or my Sunday evening, Jesus. You can have my time and my talents, but not my treasures. That's too much, Jesus. If we're honest, we're afraid that Jesus will ask something too great of us, and so we clutch the things that we hold dear lest he try and take them away from us. But this story isn't about selling all of your possessions. That's the story about the rich young ruler. This is a story about transformation and transfiguration of your relationships. Your relationships with your friends and family, with wealth and possessions, with the whole of who you are and all that you have. The reality is that we so often become engrossed and entangled with what we have that we miss the one from whom all blessings flow. We can take the gifts of the Lord and turn them into false gods and idols without much effort. This is the power of sin in our lives and in our world. Subtly, the things of this world become more important than the God of this world. And when we finally realize that we are misaligned, we buy into the lie that we just need to be better or do better or try harder. Jesus doesn't tell these stories to separate the weak from the strong, the chosen from the gathered, the spiritually rich from the morally weak. No, he isn't trying to weed out those who can't or won't make the cut because he knows that of our own strength, none of us can do it. Instead, he is inviting all of his hearers, he's inviting us, to realign our priorities, our principles, our people, and our possessions around his kingship and his kingdom. When Christ is king, everything belongs to God and not to us. The cost of discipleship is that we seek to serve God with all that we have, with all that he has given us, not for our glory, but for his, out of gratitude for what he has done because of what we can't do. There is no quick fix for a transfigured life or transformed relationships, but we love an easy button, don't we?
That was easy.
We love a spiritual plan of do 100 spiritual push-ups, 20 spiritual burpees, drink your high-protein, low-calorie spiritual tonic, and you too can have a spiritual six-pack in 7 days. Most of us are looking for the next spiritual hack, the right spiritual pill or shot, the next cafeteria plan which will get us back on track. But my friends, Jesus didn't come to bring an easy button or a life hack or a pill. Because of sin, we are in debt up to our eyeballs, and our possessions, our wealth, and our relationships have not, cannot, and will not save us. The true, beautiful, and good news is that Jesus has already carried the cross that he calls us to pick up. This passage is situated within the larger context of Jesus' journey to Jerusalem, where he willingly, knowingly, and intentionally climbs onto the cross. We are called to pick up our cross and follow after the one who has already done it, who has already won it, because in him it has been finished. His yoke is easy and his burden is light. Taking up our cross isn't a strength test or a spiritual flex. It is a long obedience in the same direction. Jesus doesn't call the strong and the mighty and the put together. He calls the least, the last, the lost, the left out, and the lonely. He calls the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the sinners. He calls those who cannot help themselves because he alone can save them. And in case anyone is uncertain, we are all on that list, all of us, every single one. The cost of discipleship is great, but the cost of not following Jesus is even greater. If we take Jesus at his word, which we should, and we believe that he is the Messiah who has come to seek and to save, which he has, then the alternative to following Jesus is separation from God. We cannot pay the price, but God graciously paid the price for us with his Son and then gave us his Holy Spirit that we might be able to follow after him. The life of discipleship is true and beautiful and good. It involves hearing the shepherd's voice, listening for his call, trusting his leadership, and growing in his likeness. It means giving up our stranglehold on our control and our efforts and our self-righteousness and realizing that the only way to win is to lose. And the only way to gain is to give up. So how much does it cost to follow Jesus? Everything. Will it be worth it? Yeah. How do you do it? To be in discipleship up to your eyeballs. Not in debt, but in grace upon grace. And all God's people said,